Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. If you'd like to find more sessions, interviews, and story podcasts, visit our podcast page at www.educause.edu/podcasts or search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. This podcast features a program session from the EDUCAUSE 2010 Annual Conference.
I think one of the most important things that I've had an opportunity to understand as I've been around Internet 2 and regional networking and campus networking and global networking is that this enormous value that the work we've done together is the result not of any single organization or any single person, but it really is the byproduct of a very complicated ecosystem. And for those of you who spent time studying biology and therefore learning about ecosystems, and for those of you who have a good sense of what that means, an ecosystem performing a set of functions has very different characteristics than an organization performing functions. And when you look at what we have achieved in the past and what we need to achieve in the future, I'm trying very hard to not just think about Internet 2, but to recognize that Internet 2 is merely a part of a very complex ecosystem, and that it's really the way that ecosystem works or doesn't work that ultimately defines whether we're successful or not successful. And that ecosystem extends from, you know, the folks who use the technology platforms that we put out there for them, to what we call the local level, whether, you know, traditionally been the university campus, and many of you have been responsible for building that. We've built the state entities, and we've aggregated state entities into regional networks. We've done it in the U.S., and we've done it globally. We have built projects to interconnect all that at the national level, and that was the history, really, of projects like Internet 2. And increasingly, given the nature of the business that we're in and the 200-plus universities that own this entity and rolled it up in 1996, you can't really think about this ecosystem without thinking about it globally. The extent and degree to which the missions of Internet 2's member universities have ceased to become just national missions and have increasingly become defined by how they position themselves with respect to global programs, and that's in science and education and service. We have to, if we're going to effectively build the technology platforms to enable that, are going to also now begin to have to recognize that it really truly is global. This ecosystem, it's so easy to forget this, but it's so important, is built on partnerships, Anna. And like all ecosystems, the key kind of managing concept, as opposed to, quote, organizational management concepts, is balance, is understanding the elements of your ecosystem, is understanding the division of functions in the ecosystem and where each element of the ecosystem fits and what the boundaries are between the elements in the ecosystem. Ecosystems have to have, to work effectively and not break down, rationalized economic models. for the way resources are applied at the base of the economic system and work their way through the ecosystem in a way that all of the elements of the ecosystem that are important to us have the fuel and whether it's natural resources, whether it's dollars, whether it's whatever, have the resource base to be able to continue to perform the function in the ecosystem. Ecosystems also have an amazing, and I know it's an artificial application as we work to try to understand ecosystems, to argue that ecosystems have a kind of a common, you know, have to have a sort of a coherent architecture. And you have to be able to apply sort of common language and common conceptual constructs to ecosystems in order to be able to characterize them in ways that you can understand them well enough to be able to know whether something you're doing represents a potential threat to imbalancing the ecosystem. And so as I take on this leadership of the organization that we started a number of years ago as the University Corporation for Advanced Internet Development, that you all know mostly by what I consider to be a brand, and that is Internet 2, the networking strategy that became the work we did that defined the first era of this organization. It among the things that I'm trying to most effectively keep in my mind is that it's not just about one organization in the ecosystem. It's not just about one piece of the ecosystem. But we all have a responsibility to make sure that we recognize how all of those pieces work together. And so my goal is to engage all of the folks in the community around Internet 2 in a collaborative process that's focused not on the good of any single element, but on the balance and effectiveness of the ecosystem as a whole. We're going to need that as we move forward now. And I'm going to actually kind of talk about two things today. I'm going to talk about some of the challenges that we have in Internet 2. And then I'm going to spend more time talking about the big challenge that we have in Internet 2 called BTOP or US-UCAN, which is, as many of you know, the major grant that the organization just received to build additional capacity in the national backbone to be able to interconnect scores of new connectors from a community of institutions that have become known as community anchors. And you're talking about community colleges, K-12s, emergency management organizations, research parks, state and local governments, who have never, at least through this point, been able to benefit from the value of the fundamental proposition of taking bandwidth, removing bandwidth as a barrier to being able to achieve your goals using technology. And so we're going to dig down a little bit and talk about what this project means, because it is an opportunity and a mandate, I believe, for everyone who's engaged in technology and applications at American universities, and particularly Internet 2 member universities, to understand how this is unfolding and to begin to think about what your role is in this. But addressing this isn't the only challenge that, you know, we have got to deal with. That whole ecosystem that I talked about, including Internet 2, is at a very interesting inflection point where we have obviously the traditional work that we've done, which is what got us where we are, you know, which is building this extraordinary regional campus, regional, national, and global mesh of high-performance broadband networks that are used by, certainly now, all the major and well beyond that, institutions of higher education in the world. What we've achieved has been extraordinary, and we can't let up in trying to make sure we continue to focus on that, because we know there are new challenges. We know that advanced networking is something that we've done extraordinarily well in the research and education community for the last two or three decades. And by doing it well, and by doing it collaboratively, we have created value for our institutions that I don't think you could probably put a price tag on at this point in time. But sort of in addition to that, we are also challenged by our, particularly by our COO members, to recognize that it's not just networking that we need to do at scale, and we need to do collaboratively. It's an interesting phenomenon, I think, that when we started Internet 2, and I think back, and you know, I'm actually bizarre enough that I can remember back that far, although I have trouble remembering what happened last night. If you looked around the table in the room at the Chicago O'Hare Airport, where a group of CIOs gathered and made the decision to move forward on creating this new national network strategy, in all but two or three cases, the CIOs who were in the room had a single senior officer reporting directly to them, whose only responsibility, only portfolio was networking. If I take that equivalent group now and I look at the organizational structures, which of course mirror organizational strategies, at those same universities, only two or three of them still have a single senior officer who reports to them who does nothing but networking. For the most part, what has happened in that last 10, 11, 12 years is that the lines between network infrastructure, storage infrastructure, computational services have essentially been blown away. It's all now taking place in a completely different context that requires much higher levels of focus on resiliency, for instance, because it's become so critical and we've become so dependent on it, and scalability, because you know we have to be able to scale up and down, and security. That increasingly what you see in universities is you see organizational infrastructures coming in place where there's more likely to be a senior leader who owns that whole cyber infrastructure space. Odd, though, isn't it, that in that same time period, in terms of the collaborative work we do together, we have kept, for the most part, our national infrastructure organization focused on the single networking layer. We have gotten badly out of sync with what the CIOs in our community need to be working on together and at scale. And there are a lot of interesting challenges that have come across as a result of that, particularly when you see major technology shifts like the emergence of cloud services and software as a service, and you see the rapid evolution of the technology translating into completely different service models, which have essentially gotten away from our CIO owners in a significant way, and finding ourselves in a situation now where our ability to engage in above the cloud services is defined by what Google or Amazon or somebody thinks we should have, not by what we know is in our best interest. And so there are expectations that we do there. We're going to talk about USUCAN. We have a lot of work to do in increasing the definition and the boundary between regional networking in the U.S. and national networking. And frankly, I know there are some of our international members and partners in the room. The same issues exist all around the world, in Europe, in Latin America. And while I say on the outside, it looks like our ecosystem is one big, smoothly functioning delivery mechanism, in the inside, we know that it has a lot of broken pieces. That, you know, we've got so many different business models underlying our regional networks in the U.S. that when it comes to dealing with a major national corporate partner like Northrop Grumman, which has 10 or 11 research labs over the country that they want to connect, that they have to go through the unmitigated, you know, nightmare of trying to have 10 or 11 different contracts, 10 or 11 different relationships in order to work across the national level. We've had the same problem with our federal agencies. And so our ecosystem isn't well rationalized between the layers. And while there's a general sense of how the divisions in the system are separated between the national and the regional and the campus layers, it's not sufficiently rationalized to be able to address new challenges and opportunities like USU can, and we'll talk about that again in a little bit. I think nothing has changed every industry around the globe like the pure concept of globalization has. And research and education is no exception to that. And in fact, probably in a very real sense, represents the single most globally competitive advantage that the United States has in the world right now. And at the same time, it's becoming increasingly clear as you look at research. Research has gone from individual, you know, sort of individual PI research to small team collaborative research to large team collaborative research to mega research in order to address the level of challenges that exist in science, the large puzzles, to the point where a single nation can no longer even afford to build all of the science infrastructure it needs to solve large-scale problems. You saw the wealthiest country in the world drop out of trying to build the next-generation linear accelerator by itself. And there's a field of mushrooms down in Texas, you know, that represent a history there of thinking that a single nation can roll up a science program by itself. And so we opted into the Large Hadron Collider at CERN and made major science investments there. That means our researchers have to get to that. We don't do space exploration by ourselves any longer because we can't afford to. You know, our astronauts are participating in the Russian program. You know, we shuttle our astronauts back and forth to our space station using Russian rockets. We haven't built a new telescope in this country in 35 years. All of the major national telescope facilities are being built in the Southern Hemisphere because that's the only effective place you can build them now to limit the amount of ambient light to enable yourself to do the science. And so in science, in medical research, the tentacles of globalized organization of research in the emerging systems medicine space, which is a high cost research domain to participate in when you're talking about mapping the human genome and applying that to theories and techniques of clinical care, you're talking about massive scale research that, again, we have moved to the point where many of those large-scale projects aren't organized within the U.S., but are often organized with European partners, increasingly with Asian partners. And so the main research domain of healthcare and medical research has become global. And so in all of these spaces. And so when we think about the technical platform that is needed to be able to support this, it's got to be global. You know, our researchers have got to be able to use instrumentation in Latin America just like it was, you know, in South America, just like it was next door. They've got to be able to get data sets out of the Large Hadron Collider without going to CERN. They've got to be able to track space exploration, management facilities in Moscow and in Florida. And so the business we're in has become global, absolutely global. The next big challenge that I have to focus on is, you know, we have a set of anchor tenants in this business, and those are the researchers. And no matter what we go off and do, the primary drivers of why we made this investment was to support research. And we all know that supporting research is a terribly difficult thing to do, that the researchers don't pay their own way, that they have high expectations, and no matter what you do for them, they seem to have low levels of satisfaction. You deal with that all on the campus level. You know, we deal with it at a national level. But in point of fact, it is the community that has the most critical challenges, presents us with the most critical challenges that keep us on the leading edge of technology. We do networking well ahead of in our community, well ahead of what AT&T and private corporations do, because we're working against the requirements that are defined by leading edge research. And we've learned again and again and again and again that when we build infrastructure and applications against requirements driven out of the research community, that it has remarkable application outside the research community. That what we did 25 or 30 years ago in rolling out the internet, okay, which we did to support research, has fundamentally transformed telecommunications and field after field after field after field. I don't see that changing. It reminds me, but it's not an easy community to work with. It reminds me, I used to have a neighbor who was in the shopping mall development business, and I used to complain about researchers, and he complained about anchor stores. You know, they lose money on them. You know, they get better deals than anybody else does. They actually get part of the profits. You know, Macy's, when it goes into a mall, actually gets part of the profits of the mall. But you can't have malls without them, because they're who brings the customers for everything else. It's kind of a weak analogy, but a lot of the same dynamics about how we have to develop the relationships with researchers. And we can't do this without industry involved. And so we have a whole series. We're at this terrific inflection point, and we have this whole series of challenges that face this ecosystem that I talked about, and not just Internet 2, but the other organizations that are part of this, our fellow NREN managers in other parts of the world, our campus IT, you know, our campus CIOs, and our regional network leadership. What I want to talk more specifically about, though, because this is where I really, you know, need to get you thinking about how your institution and you carve out a role in this, is our United States Unified Community Anchor Network Program. I think you are all aware, but I'll give you just a little bit of background, that the United States government has never made any substantial investment in building broadband infrastructure, whether for research or anything else. You're also aware that in response to the economic challenges, that a significant program of government investment was made to create more positive momentum in the economy. There were, to our advantage, a number of people in the Obama administration who had grown increasingly interested in the developing understanding of the relationship between broadband networking infrastructure and development. And for the first time, this program identified a total of, between the Department of Commerce and Department of Agriculture, a total of $7 billion to be invested in programs to build broadband infrastructure in the United States, with a very short timeline for implementing that. I'm proud to say that the leadership of Internet 2 that was in place well before I got there saw this as an extraordinary opportunity for us to bring to the attention of the national leadership the extraordinary success stories associated with what we've done building research infrastructure in higher education at the national and at the regional level. And so I'll give you some statistics later. By the time this program rolled out its final funding announcements, I think last week, over $1 billion of funds were made available to interconnect community anchors. And again, these are, we'll talk a little bit more about that later, schools, K-12, community colleges, et cetera, to connect community anchors to the national R&E backbone network. Approximately 200,000 of these kind of public service institutions around the country. Interestingly enough, about 60,000 of those are already connected through our regional networks. But this implies another 140 to 200,000 probably additional entities that have the potential to connect. And there is now an enormous amount of investment out there to be able to facilitate the middle mile structure and in many cases the last mile structure for that, including a lot of investment in things beyond connectivity, community computing centers. And our community submitted a number of proposals to federal government at the national level and from our regional networks and partnerships that they built. Relevant to our national strategy, we received a $63 million federal grant to enable us to rebuild our national backbone network, to acquire the dark fiber IRUs, and to essentially build that infrastructure from scratch, representing an extraordinary opportunity for us. At the same time, many of our regional networks were funded to extend connections to community anchors throughout the country, as well as a number of other entities that don't involve our regional networks that were funded to do the same thing, creating an interesting challenge for us. This talks about the partners who were a party to the proposal. What I think this, on if you could move on, what I think this does is create a very interesting opportunity for us. The money we got was about extending our connectivity infrastructure. But the end game, and the one that is of the most interest to the folks who are allies in the administration, is that they want to see the same transformations go on in these other community anchor sectors as a result of having access to virtually unlimited broadband networking that they have seen go on in the university community. They want to see the same level of innovation. And so what we committed to in this proposal, that we did not get funded, but that we have to organize the capacity of all of our members to effectively, and all of our organizations to effectively do, is to agree to work with those communities to establish an entity that was called, that is, may be called, it was the name we used, United States Unified Community Anchor Network, that will be organized in a way that enables the kind of collaboration and development, mutual development of capabilities to occur in those communities that has happened in the R&E community. So effectively, we're being asked to go apply our organizational and innovative strategies to working together to acquire network assets and build applications and build communities to these communities. And in exchange, the federal government is providing us with a bunch of money to upgrade our networks to be able to handle the traffic. It's actually a little bit scary because, again, the second piece we were not funded to do, and we have to figure out how we're going to organize our efforts to do it. It seems to me that this represents an extraordinary opportunity for higher education and Internet 2 members in this country right now. I think up until now, we have defined the work we've done around the two concepts, the primary concept of research and the secondary concept of education. And our networks support research and education. But I've had the privilege to serve on two committees at two major American universities who've been tasked to develop a new mission statement. And what was interesting about that was that in neither of those cases was that mission statement confined to research and education. That in both instances, it combined research and education and service. So a few weeks ago, I went out and started some web surfing, looking at the mission statements of as many universities as I could find one for quickly, and discovered that every one of them really defined research, defined the major universities in this country, public or private, not as just having research missions and education missions, but all ultimately coming together on service mission. And so I think that this represents an extraordinary opportunity for us to engage universities in this process in a way that we've never been able to engage universities before, to create real working relationships between our universities and our colleges and these other community anchor sectors in ways that create enormous potential for higher education to provide leadership that is badly needed in this country right now around the ability to deliver public services. I think if we can do it successfully, it will essentially reshape and has the potential to reshape the image and perception of higher education in this country right now at a very important time. That in fact, if we can pull these things together, we've sort of hit a mission trifecta here, that we're no longer talking about R and E networking, but we're talking about R and E and S networking. And that's truly reflective of the real missions of the institutions that we are all part of. I want to talk, in fact, a little bit about the kinds of things that are going on out there give us a foundation on which to build. We've got already an enormous amount of engagement from American colleges and universities in the community, engaged with economic development, community colleges, public libraries, public safety, healthcare, home broadband. Recall the history of higher education in this country, in the 1600s and 1700s, as the university system began to develop in the United States, it was very much built upon the European model of the academy, mostly with a very, very, very tight and coupled connection to religious roots. But as the United States began to expand in the 1800s and move west, it became very obvious that the kind of people that were being educated in those schools made great politicians and governors and senators and teachers, but they didn't make very good engineers. They didn't know how to build a railroad. They didn't know how to build a canal. They did, and doing those things was becoming very scientific. And so in the mid-1800s, and I know many of you from the U.S. are familiar with this, there was a major landmark program, legislative program enacted called the Morrill Land Grant Act. And the Morrill Land Grant Act actually put federal money into the creation of a university in every state in the United States under the proviso that that university would continue to be focused around what you would characterize now as practical education. And that they would become vanguards in supporting the development of the United States, the growth of our civil cultures in the U.S. And so you saw this proliferation of cooperative extension programs of states. All of you who work for a state land-grant university recognize that you have a very different mission than many others because a good bit of your focus is on the community. So we do a lot of this already, and we've got scores of examples of this. Economic development, you know, among Internet 2 members. In Memphis, the University of Memphis has taken a long-time role in... University of Memphis is actually not a land-grant university either, so it's not just the land-grant university. To support economic development initiatives and have really dug in to working with Tennessee-based companies like FedEx in economic development. On the next. Higher education heavily engaged in healthcare. Think about what the value is and will be in having community-based acute care hospitals connected to the same broadband network as our major university medical centers and hospitals. Think about our ability to have enough bandwidth to deploy telepresence in every major university hospital and in every community hospital, and the value that that brings to the extension of the high-end healthcare model out from the core all the way out into rural areas. And we already have universities doing this all over the country. The example we picked here was the work that Ornett is doing and Ohio State are doing in connecting rural hospitals to the Children's Hospital in Columbus, which is an extraordinary Midwestern resource in children's care, and utilizing technologies that couldn't possibly have been deployed, even 5 years ago to support the delivery of healthcare. Next. Engagement with libraries, pushing these enormous library resources that we've all invested in out into the communities in ways that we gain greater value from them. Again, the example we grabbed here was from Ohio, but there are probably 15 or 20 other state-based projects where the library community is already pushing library services out across the networks that we use. And this is really now, this program is now particularly focused on making sure that every community library in the country is connected to the broadband network. Think about the transformation that that can create in terms of allowing universities to deliver services in the community layer to transform the work we do. On the next, the growing relationship between our university members and this extraordinarily critical layer of education in this country called community colleges. In most major universities, the march has been up the value chain in the last two decades, to more and more specialized research, more and more focused education programs, more and more specialized education programs, more costly programs, to get through one of our member universities, students are leaving with in some cases, most cases, tens of thousands of dollars worth of debt. In many cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt. And so we're really working in this country to try now to figure out how we factor the development of our community college systems into a fully developed educational fabric. And up until now, these two islands of universities and community colleges couldn't be further apart in terms of the way they work together to enable the educational goals in the U.S. Now they're going to be on the same network. Now they're going to be on the same high bandwidth network. What we can do there becomes extraordinary. Higher education and public safety. Scores of universities in the last 5 to 10 years have built new programs to assure we can train the next generation of public safety leadership, which we know from some of the massive breakdowns we've had in managing public safety in a country as economically advanced as the U.S. is a significant byproduct of the absence of a layer of extremely capable leadership who can organize the delivery of those services effectively. Universities have gotten into that business in big ways. In the state of New Jersey, for instance, the New Jersey Educational Network received a $40 million BTOP award to build an interoperable wireless public safety broadband network, connecting more than 160 law enforcement agencies and 200 fire departments who use this network infrastructure to support trauma centers communicating across the network. Think about the value of projecting an emergent technology like telepresence into community emergency management entities that enable a level of coordination and collaboration that has never been present in those communities. So this represents an extraordinary opportunity for us. But even then, in some other places, we have a long history of universities stepping up to taking care of the communities they're part of from a technology perspective. We've got the history of Blacksburg Village in Blacksburg, Virginia, where Virginia Tech took a leadership role in deploying this. We're seeing other institutions begin to do this, and it is very much on the minds of Anish Chopra, although sometimes I think he has more than one mind, to see universities step up to getting back in the business of providing leadership in the development of network connections within their communities. Steve, it's interesting to see this old community networking idea come back again, isn't it? We've got scores of examples. The one that I think is catching most attention now, if you take a look at it, is the work that Case Western is doing in the area around their campus in Cleveland. That, you know, is not just providing connectivity to about 25,000 residents in what is generally a pretty economically deprived area, but is also now pushing out programs and supporting the development of education and enrichment programs in Cleveland. And, you know, this represents, I think, as we move forward, a call to arms here, and the BTOP awards that are coming out really help us facilitate that. So we've got a lot of work to do here, and we have a pretty complicated and challenging puzzle that we have to construct here. You know, we've got our ecosystem of providers down the left hand side. And we've got these new communities who now have been funded to connect to our network, and higher ed, K-12 libraries, community health, public safety, research parks. And if all it becomes about in the long run is connectivity, it will not make the kind of impact that it has the potential to make. In point of fact, all it will do will be get higher education in an unending battle with commercial providers like AT&T and others who are in this same business. What it becomes for us is how we use and deploy these networks in a way that facilitates the development of programs and services and applications on these infrastructures that enable these community public service institutions to do their job more effectively. And as I alluded earlier, my own perspective on that as someone whose academic background is political science is that we're experiencing, particularly in the U.S. right now, but I think all around the world, a a really dangerous breakdown in the ability of government to provide, in many cases, even fundamental services to the citizens. The byproduct of that is the citizenry is losing confidence in the institutions that we've created, regardless of the political system we represent. And as they lose confidence, they withdraw from the civic culture. And when they withdraw from the civic culture, you see enormous political destabilization. This is an extraordinary opportunity for us as universities to re-engage in these communities in ways they never had. So the question I have for you as you think about your institution and you watch this program now start to unfold is, where do you fit? Where do you fit? Where does your institution fit? Do you have programs that are already engaged with these community anchors? If so, how can you transform those programs when we've got those community anchors connected to our national R and E and S network infrastructure? The work ahead of us is major here. The expectations for the national political leaders who funded this program are high. We know we have a lot of work to do to get our community organized and to get our system, our very complicated system, organized to do this effectively. But we also know how capable we are of doing these things as a community when it becomes important. So what I want to do a little bit this morning, in addition to sort of giving you an update on Internet 2, and for those of you who came expecting this might be about advanced networking technologies, I apologize, because it's meant to be a lot more about sort of where we're going and the major challenges that we have ahead of it, in particular now, how we focus our attention on this interesting new project we have called USUCAN. So that's pretty much all I had to say. I think there's a final slide that just sort of asks them. I forgot about this part. So let me just take 2 minutes and give you an update on this. I skimmed over this in the beginning, and I actually forgot these slides were here. But this is just a summary, and I won't bother to read it, of how this has evolved. $4 billion awarded in funding for installation of approximately 120,000 miles of broadband network. Deployment of middle-mile infrastructure in areas with nearly 40 million households. Investment in more than 3,500 new or upgraded public computing clusters. 35,000 new or upgraded public computer workstations. I think there's one more slide here on it. Extending broadband access to 3,000 healthcare entities, 5,000 public safety entities. You see the numbers. Extraordinary change in the service community for R&E networking. And representing, I think, an extraordinarily extraordinary transformational opportunity. So I know that we're at the end of the conference. I've got a few more minutes left if people have questions they'd like to ask. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So if you had to guess, what would you say out of 4 billion? 1%?
I think very little. I think you'd be lucky to say 1%. I mean, remember, the source of this funding wasn't any systematic, like is so often the case, no systematic government policy to extend broadband networking, which would have dealt with those issues, but simply an allocation of funds based upon the notion that if you put a lot of money into the economy quickly, that you can stimulate it. And so all of the funds, every dollar of the funds was really about acquisition or extension of something. Now, there were some rules set up that required matching funding to be provided by the participants in the program. And there was an emphasis on making sure that you were able to document how you were going to mobilize and apply resources to achieving the objectives of your proposal. But I think it leaves yet to be determined, how we are going to find the level of resources we need to achieve the level of success that I think that I think is possible here. For us right now, Internet 2 and the USUCAN project, certainly we don't have the organizational capacity to do all this. We have to reach back into our partnerships with the regional networks, with the universities, who, as I say, are already in these spaces in active ways. We have to figure out how to identify these university programs, pull them together, and get them focused on the value add and the organization of the communities in a real way. But really good question.
So, anyway, I think
that the folks in the White House who are on board with us here get that thoroughly, and I think they're prepared to become extraordinarily good partners in bringing significant additional investment, because the capital piece isn't done either. As is obvious. I mean, the broadband needs in this country are somewhere between 75 and 100 billion, you know, and so there's still a big give there. I think what we have to really focus on doing is teeing those opportunities up for them in concrete ways and showing them how we can achieve these things and building these programs into our standard research grants and into the programs that we go to ask our state governments for dollars for and others. And I think there's a predisposition to help us there. I mean, we just had a massive win. And again, this doesn't get to the maintenance piece, but it's an example of where we get there with the with the FCC's change in the rules for applying E-rate funds. That happened week before last. I mean, we have this massive program that generates $2.75 billion every year from taxes on telecommunication carriers that goes into a program called the E-Rate that enables schools and libraries to buy technology equipment and also spend funds to support and maintain it. But the rules in the past have been such that they've never been able to spend that money on R&E network connectivity, that they've had to spend it on commercial network connectivity. We've been pushing to change that for probably 10 years with no success. And then all of a sudden, the world changed. And all of a sudden, the FCC was receptive to proposals. I think a change in recognition in, you know, our senior leadership in the administration about the critical value that this is going to have. And the FCC has gotten themselves in some serious hot water here with the incumbent carriers by making these kinds of changes. I think that we have the opportunity to take these challenges on one at a time, okay? And I think that we are focusing between Internet 2 and the other national associations that represent these community anchors. We spent a lot of time together in the last several months since we started this with lots of thinking about how we're going to affect this from Washington. And that's absolutely necessary, but it's not sufficient because the ecosystem is much more complicated than that. The funding's got to come at the local level. It's got to come at the community level. Such simple decisions, for instance, as the money that the federal government is plowing into healthcare. And the goal to create more highly automated healthcare provision. If the money gets spent on the wrong things, it doesn't advance the ball. If we can get NIH to partner with us and spend that money on the right things, then we stand a chance to be successful. You know, U.S. has put billions of dollars into emergency management in the last two or three years to the point where you've read the horror stories, you know, 10-person police departments in some little suburb, you know, in Nebraska, building and equipping a SWAT team, okay? Why did they do it? They had to spend the money, okay? There was never an option ahead of them that said, okay, take that money and spend it on 100, you know, on a 10 gig, you know, 100, you know, 1 gig network connection to a high-speed backbone, get a telepresence unit, and you're going to have telepresence connectivity to all the emergency management centers, public safety centers in the state of Nebraska, and the ability to get to FEMA, and you're going to have the You know, you're going to have the ability to bring in online programs from the universities to build skill sets. Those are the kinds of discussions we have to change. And that's not just about national level action. That's got to be worked at every level of, you know, the every level of government to make it happen. So, you know, I think right now is a great time to roll up our shirt sleeves and try to pull this off. I think it will be challenged by the fact that we're in a down economy. But now remember, much of what we're achieving here with technology is about doing more with less if you can make the investment. And so we have a good story to tell, I think. Other questions?
Regarding carbon production and distribution.
Mm-hmm. Content production and distribution? Very clearly, one of the great successes of the R&E network that we built that connects our universities is our ability to move content, valuable content through that network. And the fact that you can move it means more people want to use it, which means that more investment goes into creating it. And there is clearly not only an expectation, but a great opportunity for universities to become much more important content providers to these new communities that are going to develop out there. So for instance, when every community acute care hospital is on the national broadband network, my goodness, you know, if you're running a university medical center, a university medical center research program, a clinical care delivery program, doesn't that change the way you're going to think about how you should be building content for those communities? That's both to the community advantage and also to your own benefit as well. So you know, the biggest challenge in content is in this country is the constraints created by the antiquated licensing model. And you know, for higher education, that's an extreme issue right now. I mean, we generate all this intellectual content. You know, our faculty members sell it to the publishers for pittance, and then we bankrupt our universities buying it all back, and then furthermore have to build new buildings to store it in. And so, you know, it's an irrational model that I think as part of advanced internet development, if we can't find more rational content management models and more rational economic business models for content, we've already retarded advanced internet technologies by 10 years by not having solved that problem. It will continue to be retarded at that rate. And so very much a part of what we have to do is address and work with the higher education community to address the issue of the economics of content. Questions, yeah?
So the question about how do you bring our institution in when we're a community college is to look at local universities? I mean, is that what I'm hearing you say?
No, I don't think... drive local universities. No, don't... You know, you're... Community colleges, I think, in many ways, are way out ahead of universities in engaging the community. I mean, you're driven by community priorities. I think that the benefit you'll have here as you connect to the national, is your community college connected to Internet 2 already? No, to a state and regional network now? Where are you?
Wyoming.
Okay. that gets challenging, but you know, the folks in Wyoming are doing that. Think about when you are. I mean, think about when you're on, you know, when you're able to be on, you know, a 10, 100 meg gig network connection for your community college, and how you're going to be able to more effectively connect to resources outside your college to be able to provide great experiences for students. I don't think you're going to follow universities here. I think you need to build relationships with them. You need to drag them into this community, lock, stock, and barrel. But you know, your connectivity. I don't know the layout of the BTOP funded programs in Wyoming. But we do know people in Wyoming who will I'm sure have this as very high priority. Other question? Well, I thank you all for your attendance this morning. I know you could also be making your way to the airport, and many of you are, and it's nice to have an opportunity to meet you all. So thank you very much. Thank you.
You can find more EDUCAUSE podcasts by visiting our podcast page at www.educause.edu/podcasts or search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. EDUCAUSE podcasts are now available to listen to straight from your mobile device. Just visit www.educause.edu/mobile. I'm Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.